Thank you, Carrie. Good morning, everybody. I hope Christmas went as well as possible for you and yours. Welcome to those of you who are here with family members today. Welcome to those of you who are with us by live stream this morning. We have several people who, because of special events or trips or other things like that, have decided to it'd be best to kind of do it this way this week, so our prayers with each one. I noticed on the announcement on the screen here a moment ago the reference to Psalm or to Revelation 19, and I just mentioned to you that since we don't have a bulletin today, you will be receiving a thought for the day either by email or posted on the Facebook page, so please take note of it. It's titled Four Hallelujahs and an Amen. And I think that's the right view of Revelation 19. I hope you'll read it and think about it and pray with us. 5 days. This is the fifth day from the end of 2002. And therefore, we're 35 days into our project of kind of praying through these passages together. The last two Lord's days, we looked at a gift that God offers us in Christ. The gift of presence, the gift of God's care for us, the gift of God's blessing in our lives, the gift today, one last gift, the gift of meaning. The gift of presence, the gift of trust, and then the gift of meaning. I got started thinking a few days ago for some reason about that passage in Genesis 32 where one night at a crucial time in his life, Jacob ends up wrestling apparently with God or with the pre-incarnate Christ who appears in human form. I don't understand everything about how it would be to wrestle with God in some fashion, but when morning is coming, Jacob is told to let who he's wrestling with go. And Jacob says, I will not let you go unless you bless me. That's Genesis 32 and verse 26. I won't let go until you bless me, or unless you bless me. I kind of feel that way about this weird year that we have wrestled with. I don't compare this year of life to the Lord, but I do consider even it the Lord's blessing, the Lord's sustaining us, the Lord's caring for us, and the Lord's helping us make it through. And I don't want to see us let it go without our having been blessed by it in some way and our being aware that we've been blessed by it in some way. And so let's stop and think about that this morning. I think Psalm 90, which I hope you'll turn to in your Bible, suggests that one blessing that we're in a position to take from what we've experienced this year is some sense of meaning. Meaning not only in terms of what we've been through, what we might have learned from what we've been through, but meaning in ourselves as persons. What really makes us matter, what really makes us valuable, what really makes our lives count for something other than just how long we've lived them. Psalm 90 is the prayer of Moses, the man of God, and in my mind I can almost think of him observing what happened after Numbers chapter 14 when a whole generation of Israelites were allowed by God to make their journey as if he did not exist and as if he would not give them what he'd promised them. And that really is what happens. More than simply him punishing them with the generation passing in the wilderness, he lets them live as if he weren't with them to help them. And I can almost think of Moses watching that happen. A year at a time, 40 years of it, and then offering this prayer in observation of what's going on. Psalm 90 presents us with the reality that I probably would be good for us to have in mind. I'm going to read it with you in a kind of a different way this morning. But before we do, I think the overall outlook will be important for us to have in mind. The reality that Psalm 90 establishes is that God always is. In any generation, at any time, God always is, and that He's always God. That is, that He always rules, that He always exercises sovereignty, that who He is always the measure of everything else. And this passage, verse 2 says, before the mountains were brought forth or ever had formed you had formed the earth or the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you're God. All generations. The idea that establishes is that God lives, that God endures, that God was before everything, and He'll be after everything, and that therefore He rules over everything. This, of course, is a view that Scripture always presses and always emphasizes. A little bit later in Psalm 102 and verses 25 and following, you can read this: of old You laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of Your hands. They, the earth and the heavens, will perish, but You will remain. They will wear out like a garment. You will change them like a robe, and they'll pass away. But You are the same, and Your years, in contrast to ours, have no end. That's really the starting point conviction of Psalm 90. So really the starting point in our grasp of the meaning of our own lives. Now, this psalm goes ahead to say, in contrast to God, who always is and is always God, we are dust and are returning to it. That's not an especially hopeful thought, is it? But it's the truth about our existence. This past week, I happened to see a sports piece about baseball stars, some of my heroes of my boyhood, whom we lost in 2020. In a space of 6 months, 6 Hall of Famers, and 2 of them were my favorites when I was a kid growing up. And the reporter, the voice on this impressive special, said, "We never expected that they wouldn't die. We just didn't think we would lose them all at once." It's a commentary on human experience when someone can say of even the greatest and most famous, "We never expected they wouldn't die." That's different from saying we never acted like we thought they wouldn't. In this text, the idea that the children of man or the children of Adam are returning to the dust from which they came, from which we came, is just as firm a conviction as the picture of God who is everlasting. And it casts its shadow over everything here. Moses could have looked at what happened after Numbers 14, but he'd have been reminded of what happened in the garden, the meaning of human experience. In Genesis 3 and verse 19, where God has to say, "You are dust, and you'll return to the dust." And it happens because what God didn't want enters into His creation and into the experience of people made in His image. In consequence of that, this psalm goes ahead to observe that life is short comparatively for us. Compared to God's everlasting, our life is really brief, and it'll go ahead to compare it to a flood washing down a gorge, or a dry stream bed, or grass which springs up and then withers away in a morning, much less a season, or a sigh which is and is over with. Those are all pretty strong images of how brief life can be. The emphasis is upon the fact that life is uncertain, that it's precarious, that it can bring things that are unexpected. It can be one thing in the morning and something completely different in the evening before that very day is over. And then it will go ahead to say that life has its trouble and its toil. Life is transient. It's precarious in the sense that it has its trouble and toil. So there's the background. God is and is always God. We're dust and we're returning to it. So if our lives have meaning, how? I don't think we can live, at least not well, if we assume that our lives have no meaning. And most of us are driven by the need for meaning in our lives. The perspective of this psalm is our meaning comes from what lasts and not from what doesn't. Means, therefore, that we have to think that our meaning as persons occurs in relation to the eternal God. And that really is the thought that's here. And I just want to say, for those of you who are younger than I am, who maybe do not feel your mortality as much as I would right now, that the implications of this are much more far-reaching than just how soon the end of your journey will come. Many of the issues that are really troubling our culture right now really revolve around where the meaning of our lives come from. You who are younger and have to go to school or deal with university settings or with the wider culture, either in athletics or academics or politics, know that big issues right now have to do with civil rights or equality, diversity matters. Equality is a big issue. Have you ever stopped to ask yourself, why? Where does that kind of meaning in people's lives come from? I happened upon two quotes recently. I was reading a book entitled Generous Justice by Timothy Keller, and he has two quotes side by side in it. One is from Chief Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. years ago, who wrote this: "When one thinks coldly, I see no reason for attributing to man a significance different in kind from that which belongs to a baboon or a grain of sand." That's coldly, all right. On the other hand, C.S. Lewis, writing from the Christian worldview that we are made in God's image and loved by Him and sought by Him, says this, has this paragraph in one of his best little books: "There are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal. Nations, cultures, arts, civilizations, these are mortal. And their life is to ours as the life of a gnat. It is immortals whom we joke with, work with, marry, snub, and exploit." You see what he's getting at. To say that we're made in God's image and that He cares about us and that we matter to Him makes us matter. It makes us matter a great deal. So if our meaning comes in relation to God, one of the things that stands out in Psalm 90 is the contrast between two words, a word that appears twice. Once in verse 3, you, that is God, return man to dust and say, return, O children of Adam. On the other hand, look down to verse 13. Now this is the prayer of Moses. Return, O Lord, how long? Have pity on your servants. What returns is some relation between God and man, which God attends to by the giving of His Son to establish peace between us and Him and to establish relationship between us. We focused on that recently. And that then leads to the three requests that involve the gift of meaning that are at the core of Psalm 90. So I'd like to ask you to notice that these three prayers all are exactly about a particular need that the psalm underlines. Notice with me first off what is asked in verses 11 and 12. In search of meaning, all of us who think about this ask God to teach our hearts the wisdom of fearing Him, making Him the landmark of our lives. If you think about verse 11, notice that it says, who considers the power of your anger and your wrath according to the fear of you? Now let's unpack that statement a little bit. The psalmist is looking at the experience of man in which life is brief and uncertain and troubled, and he is recognizing that what is happening here is the judgment of God against things being in his world and his creation that he never meant to be there, and then the effect that these things have on the lives of people and how much that pains God, how much it hurts Him and provokes His wrath against that which ruins what He loves. I noticed Richard L. Mays in his book on the Psalms observes that the psalm has an interpretation of the human predicament that belongs to biblical faith. Now notice this. It does not leave misery and death meaningless. What he's getting at is this psalm sees these things as expressions of God's righteous wrath against that which marred what he made and what he loved. The fear of the Lord, on the other hand, is what is needed here. The fear of you. Now, what does this mean? Mays continues. The fear of God is that awe and reverence before the sovereign deity of God, which leads to understanding the course of life in terms of the way of God and ordering life according to the will of God. I sometimes try to say to us that the fear of the Lord is what happens when we make the desire to please Him and the wholesome dread of displeasing Him the organizing principle of our lives. That's what this prayer focuses upon. It says there are few people who recognize in the brevity and uncertainty and the toil of life that the wrath of God is at work and that God should become the organizing principle in our lives. Verse 12 then says, so teach us to number our days. It doesn't mean teach us to count the calendar and to figure out how many more days we got left. It means teach us to understand how our lives really are, that we may get a heart of wisdom. that we can organize our lives in keeping with God's way and God's will, that we can make His ways and His will the thing which establishes the pattern of our lives. You will have heard what I'm about to read in some form or another. I'm reading one written by Leroy Garrett originally. I think it illustrates the heart of wisdom, the need for it. The young man told the prime minister that he hoped to study law and become a successful barrister. "Good," said the prime minister. "And then what?" The young man said he might be elected to parliament. "Great," said the prime minister. "And then what?" Then the young man, emboldened by the prime minister's encouragement, said, "Well, sir, I might, like you, one day be prime minister." The older man responded, "Ah, indeed you might, young man. And then what?" The young man, now somewhat puzzled by the question, said he'd one day comfortably retire in the country and enjoy his grandchildren. "Splendid! And then what?" said the prime minister once more. There's a pause this time. And the young man said, "Well, I suppose one day I'll die." And the prime minister said, "And that you will, young man, that you will. And then what?" There, friends, is the need for the heart of wisdom. That "then what" has something to do with what today means, what this year means, and what I might learn, what I might take away with me from this odd year. Secondly, to give us meaning, Lord, please satisfy our days. Notice the contrast now. We started at the middle of this psalm, and let's broaden out in both directions a bit. Look at verses 7 through 10 first. "For we are brought to an end by your anger, and by your wrath we are dismayed." Now notice this doesn't mean God is mad at me. What this is talking about is this is God's judgment on what happens when sin has entered human experience and into His creation. Verse 8, "You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence." Notice the "our," the plural here. God sees what's going on among people. God is aware of that. And He hates the iniquities and the secret sins and what they do to us in our relationships, in our lives. And then verse 9, "For all our days," here's the contrast I want you to see, "pass away under your wrath. We bring our years to end like a sigh," to an end like a sigh, this year for sure. "The years of our life are 70, or even by reason of strength 80, and their span is but toil and trouble. They're soon gone, and we fly away." The picture of the days and the years that's described here is the thing that like you see, if it's that way, where does the meaning come from? Well, look at the other part of it, verses 13 through 15 now, and how this thinks of the days. "Return, O Lord, how long? Have pity on your servants." And notice the change in attitude. Instead of God's wrath, now it's His compassion. That's the focus that's being asked for. "Satisfy us in the morning with your steadfast love." That's God's covenant love, His faithful love, His because He is who He is love, "that we may rejoice and be glad all our days," as opposed to our days passing under God's wrath and ending with a sigh. "Make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us, and for as many years as we have seen evil. We've seen some of that this year. It'd be well for us to see the meaning in it by appealing to God for His covenant love to help us going forward. I love the way Psalm 36 in verses 7 through 9 illustrates our dependence on God's steadfast love and what it means to us. How precious is your steadfast love, O God! The children of mankind take refuge in the shadow of your wings. They feast on the abundance of your house, and you give them drink from the river of your delights. For with you is the fountain of life. In your light do we see light. That's a beautiful way of saying what happens when God answers the prayer that's prayed here. Not days filled with trouble and sorrow, but days filled with God's steadfast love. Satisfy our days. Teach our hearts. Satisfy our days. And third, Father, establish our work. And all this means is, please let it be that what we have aspired to, what we've prayed for, what we've tried to do, will continue to have some meaning. In this passage, contrast first verses 2 through 6, where it was said, before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth or the world, from everlasting to everlasting, your God, you return man to the dust and say, return, O children of man, for 1,000 years they are in your sight, or but as yesterday when it's past, as a watch in the night. You sweep them away like as with the flood. They're like a dream, like grass that's renewed in the morning. In the morning it flourishes and is renewed. In the evening it fades and withers. So in the whole of experience as described there, there's nothing that continues to mean anything or to matter. In contrast to that, the end of the psalm, verses 16 and 17, says, let your work be shown to your servants, and your glorious power to their children. God's work is a big deal in the Psalms. In Psalm 44 in verse 1, it starts by saying, we've heard of your work. We've heard with our ears, our fathers have told us what deeds you performed in their days and the days of old. And then it undertakes to meditate on these things and to enjoy them. In Psalm 77 at verse 12, for example, you'll see someone who's doing this. It says, I will ponder, back up to verse 11 also, I will remember the deeds of the Lord, and I'll remember your wonders of old. I'll ponder all your work and meditate on your mighty deeds. And then in Psalm 92 and verse 4, it says, I'll sing over them. I'll sing because of them. Now what that's asking is, help us to see what we do in light of what you do. And let what you do, let the favor of your work make our work matter. Verse 17, let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us, and establish the work of our hands upon us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. There are no persons who think about life and don't care whether what they did matters. One writer says, when we're made aware of all that all around us changes and that those we cherish most pass away, the human spirit yearns for the constant and the lasting. Mine does, doesn't yours? Then more than ever, we need to find a relation to something reliable and enduring as a refuge from all that is not. And that, folks, is what Psalm 90 is talking about what it's calling us to and what it's offering to us. It's telling us that the eternal God has been our dwelling place, our place of safety, our place of refuge in all generations. He has been in mine, He is now, He will be in yours if you're six, if you're 10, if you're 18. There's no lasting thing in life except your relationship to the Lord. And of all the things we might have had occasion to learn in 2020, that could be the top of the list. We all should have learned this year the wisdom of numbering our days, the satisfaction of what's new every morning, and that's the steadfast love of the Lord, and that what's done in and for Christ is what will last. And if we learn that, then our having been through that this year, what we've been through this year, hasn't been wasted at all. You need not let this year pass without God, without allowing God to bless you with one last gift more important than all the others, and that is the meaning of a human being's life. We read the other day in Revelation, "Blessed are the dead who die in the Lord henceforth. Yea, says the Spirit, for they will rest from their labors, and their works follow with them." Let the Lord bless you with meaning. If you need to make the good confession today, be baptized into Christ. If we can help you, assist you, that would be our joy. If there's something that needs to be prayed over as a family of the Lord's here, then let's attend to that before this old year runs out. If we can help you, let us know by coming here while we stand and sing.